twistier than like a chubby checkered dance off. And I'm not complaining because it like somehow this works and it's really entertaining. From the Emirates Literature Foundation in Dubai, this is the Boundless Book Club, the podcast that is actively plotting to manipulate your TBR list. You're here with me, Andrea.
And me, Annabelle. It is a gorgeous sunny morning here, but we're not fooled. We know there is always darkness lurking beneath the surface. And today we're talking about sneaky, manipulative, and secretive behavior. Today we're talking secrets and lies. With us today, we have our colleague Maham Uzair, and joining shortly is the fabulous, internationally best-selling writer of psychological crime fiction, Sophie Hannah. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. So, Andrea, you should go first. So what have you been reading recently that is full of manipulative behavior and secrets and lies?
Okay, so I would like to start by reading you the first lines of this book, just three lines.
Okay.
My name is Amber Reynolds. There are three things you should know about me. One, I'm in a coma. Two, my husband doesn't love me anymore. Three, sometimes I lie.
Ooh.
The title of my book today is perfect for this topic because it's called Sometimes I Lie. It's by Alice Feeney. And it first came out in 2017. But right now it's being made into a TV show with starring Buffy, or I should say Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Buffy
forever. And the story is Amber wakes up in hospital, or rather she doesn't wake up. She gains consciousness, but she can't move or communicate. And the story alternates between her paralyzed present, the week before the accident, and some diaries from 20 years ago. And there's this growing sense of dread as we learn more about her family situation, her childhood, and then this current locked-in situation, which doesn't seem quite right. And I was thinking about how to talk about this. You know, when you're a kid and you go for froyo or ice cream and they say, which toppings would you like? And you're there going, I want all of them. This is that book. Only instead of like toppings, what you get is all the thriller tropes, like all of them in one book. There's so much stuff going on and it's like you've got all the options and it's twistier than like a chubby checkered dance off. And I'm not complaining because it like somehow this works and it's really entertaining. So really my biggest complaint is that I can't really tell you stuff because then I ruin it. If you like Girl on a Train or anything of that genre, like The Woman in the Window, anything like that, I think you'll like this. And now I think is a really good time to read it before it comes to the small screen. And I read a review of this book that I want to just read you one line from because I thought this was really accurate. This story is written like the most diabolical onion you've ever encountered in your life. Every time you've peeled away a layer that will get you closer to the truth, it turns out that layer was a goddamn liar. You get a pathological liar, you get a woman in a coma, you get this childhood diary, you get an evil sister, an imaginary friend, a boyfriend from the past. Like there's so much good stuff.
I feel like you're describing a telenovela, not a crime thriller.
Yes. I mean, they've got some crossover. I can't wait to watch it on the screen after having read it. I think it'd be really, really good.
When's it out on screen?
I don't know. I think they're filming it now.
Okay.
So I guess it depends on how quick they are. It's a Warner Brothers production, I think. So this is like a quick beach read. It's hugely enjoyable. But I think you have something that's enjoyable in a slightly different way, Maham, and perhaps not a beach read.
I think it would be the opposite of a beach read. So the book that I chose is not a new release. It's an old favorite. It's The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. And it won the Booker Prize in 1997. It's a family saga about an Indian family. It's focused on these two seven-year-old twins, Esther and Rahul. And it starts off in 1993, when these formerly inseparable twins are now reunited after 25 years, and then it keeps on having these flashbacks to the events of 1969. And I thought it was a good one for this week because everything is laid bare in the first chapter. But then as you keep progressing, you find out that there are little morsels of information that the author had withheld. And, you know, it keeps on adding these layers and this dimension. And you're like, oh, so this is what was happening. I don't want to give away the story, but yeah.
So are the secrets the character secrets or the author secrets?
So the writing, definitely, there is like almost a style of omission. And so the writing style definitely contributes to it. But yes, the characters have a lot of secrets. This is one dysfunctional family. I mean, they're a big Indian family. And so all of these characters come with their own little secrets. And, you know, they have these motivations for doing the things that they do. And I think the problem is that they might have remained family secrets, but it all combusts because there are these external circumstances. There's, you know, there's the promise of communism in India. There's this fervor of Christianity. And then you have the rigid caste system, sexism and racism. And then it all colludes. And then there's like an implosion and then an explosion. And yeah, there's a lot happening here.
I was saying to Maham before that I remember reading this book and it felt like it just took over my life. So when I look back on it, I think I read it for like several months, but actually it's not as thick as I remember it at all. You read it, you reread it in a day or something.
2 days. But yes, I think this is the thing when you read a book again and, you know, you've built it up in your mind to be this monumental piece of work, but actually it wasn't that difficult to read. It was really easy to read. And I really enjoyed rereading it because there were so many things that I felt like I hadn't discovered the first time around. And looking at it with fresh eyes was really good. And then it's almost like a textbook of morality. I think it's because I was thinking about the podcast topic, right? So I was like, what are the secrets and lies within this book? And I was like, oh, so a lie doesn't have to be complicated. It can be just one word. And, you know, like it was like constantly I was almost like doing a scientific study of it. And I think I quite enjoyed it, looking at it with new eyes.
The language that she uses in God of Small Things is really wonderful and unusual. And she uses
Do you have any quotes? Oh, sorry.
I do have quotes, but actually Andrea has a great quote that explains it so perfectly and it's short.
Yeah. So when we were talking about this, I was saying how I still remember how they were in some kind of dramatic situation and speaking about something that was quite difficult. And this woman, I think it was the mother of this family, was sort of, she was open to discussing it for a short period of time. And then she closed her face like a cupboard. And I was reading that line several times. And then I was like, I'm going to have to read this to someone else. She closed her face like a cupboard. And it's very unique.
There's this quote. I'm going to quote Arundhati Rai directly. She says, all that had been in the papers, the official version, of course, the thick-lipped man with rings had no idea about the other version. And, you know, that's it. Sometimes a version is just another version of the truth. That's what a lie is.
That's very good. I think that's an excellent choice for this topic. Now, before we bring in Sophie Hannah, could you tell us a bit about your book, Annabelle?
So, The Couple at the Table by Sophie Hannah. So, first thing to say about this book is you kind of approach it, I think, knowing if you've been looking at bookshelves for a few years, that Sophie Hannah has been responsible for some really successful continuations of Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot novels. So she's kind of already an established fantastic crime writer. And my expectations were really high coming to this. I thought, you know, if anybody's going to be able to write a really interesting story about an impossible murder, it will be Sophie Hannah. And I was right. And I'm just going to give you the rough blurb that you will come to if you look at the back of the book. So picture this, you're on your honeymoon at an exclusive couples only resort. And you receive a note warning you to beware of the couple at the table nearest to yours. And at dinner that night, there are 5 other couples present, and none of their tables is any nearer or further away than any of the others. And it's as if someone has set the scene in order to make the warning note meaningless. But why would anyone do that? You have no idea. You also don't know that you're about to be murdered, or that once you're dead, all the evidence will suggest that no one there that night could possibly have committed the crime. So who is trying to warn you? And who might be about to commit the perfect impossible murder? So that's the gist of quotes. First of all, would you read that based off of that description?
Would and did.
Would and did. Maham, is it your kind of thing or not?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Adding to cart right now.
Adding to cart. Okay, so the way this works, I actually really like the way this is set up. So you're presented with, you're given an introduction to this couples only resort. It's set in this beautiful, beautiful estate that everyone kind of can't believe is so perfect. One of my favorite descriptions is actually where they're describing just how opulent and beautiful it is. And the main character that we're introduced to, Lucy Dean, one of the most important things that happens in the story that is kind of central to the plot is she goes to this resort with her fiance, Pete. And while she's there, she bumps into her ex-husband, William, and his new wife, Jane Brinkwood. Jane Brinkwood. Now, Jane Brinkwood is the lady who ends up being murdered. And you find this out from the very start. I'm not giving any spoilers. It's already really interesting from a character point of view, regardless of the actual solving of the crime itself, because you find out that Jane Brinkwood was Lucy's doula and that her husband essentially ran off with the doula and left Lucy and her 2-week-old newborn baby behind. So you already feel an affinity with Lucy as a character, and you're kind of on her side. And she's talking about arriving at this resort and looking around her. And she said Lucy had been to Mauritius on her honeymoon with William 10 years ago to Bali for her mother's 60th birthday, to San Francisco for a conference. In none of those places had she found the level of luxury that Tevenden offered. Every tap, every light switch, each square foot of landscape garden and pool terrace looked as if it had been chosen after someone had asked, "But haven't you got anything rarer, smoother, more perfect and more expensive that we can use instead?" So that's the setting.
It sounds like Dubai.
That's what I was thinking as well. But what's fun about this, I don't know if you enjoyed this as well, Andrea, but you feel part of the... You feel more part of the proceedings than I found in a lot of crime mysteries. So there's like little diagrams that police officers, the sergeants and detectives are putting together and reworking maps of what the resort looked like and where the tables were placed. And you get these lists of suspects, and it feels like you're part of solving it. And I think that she paces it really well. So you go back and forth through, you know, what was actually happening at the time, what's happening in the present day as they're still trying to solve this impossible murder. And I just think it's really well done. It was engaging from start to finish. I couldn't really fault it as a twisty, turny, unpeeling the layers sort of book.
Although it's set in modern, you know, modern times, and it's got technology and all sorts of things that didn't exist back in Agatha Christie's days, it did feel like it was in her spirit almost, which I don't know if it's just me thinking that because I've read the Poirot books she's written, or if it's actually just a perfect example of that kind of murder mystery with the locked room and the quite implausible clues that you don't find implausible at the time because you're so caught up. I really enjoyed it.
I've got one final thing that I wanted to share because I thought it was a weird moment of cuteness in an otherwise quite serious topic. So Lucy's talking about falling in love with her fiance. Okay, so she says the only person who'd said anything consoling about her situation while her friends were kind of dithering about not saying anything too directly condemning about William because they wanted to remain friends with both of them. She says the only person who actually said anything consoling was her fiance Pete at the time. And he said, "They're the lowest of the low and the scummiest of the scummy. And this isn't just my opinion. It's an objective fact in the world, like gravity and the existence of kangaroos." And then later she says, "Why kangaroos? You know, I don't really get what you mean." And she said, "I think it's because they've got pouches, like they have pockets as part of their bodies. It's almost unbelievable, yet we know they really exist. And we haven't made them up because no one would make up a creature that has a body with a pocket. No one's imagination is that bizarre."
That was my favorite part of the whole book, I think. So cute.
Yeah, it was really adorable.
And on that topic, should we bring in Sophie Hannah now?
I think so.
All right.
We are delighted to be joined now by psychological crime author extraordinaire Sophie Hannah. Sophie is an internationally best-selling writer published in 49 languages and 51 territories, and a poet to boot. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sophie.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
We have just been speaking about your latest book, actually, The Couple at the Table, which came out in January, and we both enjoyed it tremendously. This is not the first outing for Simon and Charlie. So I think it is the 12th novel that they feature in.
I really need to add them up because I'm not actually sure. I thought it was the 11th, but you could be right and I could be wrong.
I think it's amazing that you've written so many that you've lost count. That's brilliant. Could you tell us a bit about Simon and Charlie as a couple and main characters? Why do they resonate with you so much, and why do you keep writing about them, and why do you think they resonate so much with readers as well?
I love Simon and Charlie as characters because they have a really strong, loyal, loving relationship. They're a married couple. So Simon is a man and Charlie is Charlotte, but abbreviated to Charlie. So they have been married for at least the last six of the books in the series, and they really love each other. And almost it's got to the point where they just couldn't exist without each other. They're a proper sort of soulmate match in a way, but in a very unusual and slightly spiky way. So they do not have a soppy kind of hearts and flowers sort of relationship. Their relationship is often quite difficult and complex, and there's some conflict in it. And sometimes Simon in particular gives Charlie not a hard time in general, sort of on purpose, but he is a very difficult, obsessive, and very odd man, basically. He is an unusual chap. And Charlie finds that immensely difficult to live with. And one of the ways she copes with it is she kind of, almost as a game to entertain herself, tries to make herself equally difficult to live with for him. So like her attitude is kind of like, if he's going to be so annoying and difficult in all these ways, then I'm going to try and annoy him by like making him go on holiday to places where I want to go that I know he doesn't find that to be his ideal type of holiday. So that's what happens in The Couple at the Table. Simon and Charlie are on holiday at a very luxurious couples only resort. And Simon would never choose to do that. Well, he would if he knew there was going to be a cryptic and baffling murder for him to solve. But in all other circumstances, he would much rather stay at home. He has a hang-up about eating in front of strangers. And at this holiday resort, everybody eats at tables on a dining terrace surrounded by all the other couples and all the other tables, hence the title. So they just have a very weird and strong and difficult relationship. And it just fascinates me. I love, you know, I think often when you read about people who love each other in fiction, it's kind of tidied up, and one could easily get the impression that all happy couples get on well all the time and see eye to eye on everything. But actually, a lot of happy marriages are based on quite a bit of spikiness and difficulty. So I just really wanted to reflect that. The other thing I should say, which is really important, is that even though The Couple at the Table is number 11 or 12 in the series, none of my Simon and Charlie series novels are written as if they are in a series. There's never, so like if you just picked up The Couple at the Table, started reading it, you would not in any way think, oh, I've missed out on some backstory here. I really need to read the previous books. So every book is written to work just as well for the reader for whom it's their first Simon and Charlie book. So The Couple at the Table and all my Simon and Charlie books, I hope, work as well as standalone crime thrillers as they do as the next in the series.
I completely felt that with this. I didn't feel like I missed out on anything, but I really love their relationship because like you said, it felt really realistic.
Thank you.
I think everybody recognized some part of their marriage in that, I think, which is wonderful. But it's interesting because you write them as if they're separate, but with the same characters, which is something that obviously one of my absolute favorite authors ever did, whose legacy you're currently custodian of. So does Agatha Christie have a strong influence on you in general from before you became involved with writing the Poirot books?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Agatha Christie was my biggest influence as a crime writer. I read her books for the first time. I've since read them four or five times each again. But for the first time, I read them when I was between the ages of 12 and 14. And she really did set the blueprint in my mind for what the ideal crime novel should be and do. And even in my, what I call my non-Poirot novels, so like The Couple at the Table, Poirot is not in that book. But even in my contemporary thrillers, there is always a very, what I call a very sort of Agatha-ish story preoccupation. So Agatha very rarely started her novels with, here's a dead body and the mystery is let's find out who killed them in a kind of ordinary way. She almost always started her novels with a mystery that's really kind of extra mysterious. Like, we just can't think of any reason why this would happen. And that kind of grips the reader in from the start, because if you can't imagine a possible reason, then you have to find out the reason. Whereas if you meet a dead body, you know someone's killed them, and then you meet four suspects, all of whom had a reason for killing them, you do want to find out, but it's like, well, it might have been him or it might have been her. The reader can sort of begin to speculate. Whereas what Agatha Christie did so frequently and so brilliantly was she would present you with an opening hook or an opening mystery, and your response as a reader is like, I just can't imagine why this would ever happen. Like in the Miss Marple novel, a murder is announced, where it starts with everybody reading an advertisement for a murder in the local paper. It says, a murder is announced. There will be a murder at 6:30 p.m. on Saturday at this particular house. And I remember reading that for the first time and thinking, but nobody would ever advertise a murder they were going to commit. Why would this ever happen? And that was what made me think, well, I have to drop everything and read this book immediately. So I've always tried to do that from my very first crime novel, Little Face, where a husband and wife cannot agree about whether the baby in the house is their baby or not. The husband insists that it is. The wife insists that the baby has been swapped for another baby while she was out of the house. And I just love, because of Agatha, starting books with what seems to be a premise that is so outlandish, borderline impossible, that I feel like the reader will have to read on to find out. And with the couple at the table, that weird detail where I just thought no one will be able to work out what's going on here and they will have to know. The opening mystery is that a woman on her honeymoon at this resort receives an anonymous warning note. And the note says in capital letters, beware of the couple at the table nearest to yours. And this note, apparently, I mean, she finds it sort of menacing and scary to receive this note, but also it appears to be meaningless because the way the tables are arranged on the dining terrace of the resort, there is no nearest table to hers. The table that she, first of all, everyone sits at a different table every night. There's no way of predicting where any couple is going to sit. And on the night that she's murdered, because she goes on to be murdered, the night that she's murdered, she and her new husband are sitting at a table in the middle of a circle of all the other tables. And every single table is exactly the same distance from theirs as all the others. So that warning, beware of the couple at the table nearest to yours, she can't work out, and the police can't work out after she dies, how that could have any meaning at all. Like, it literally seems to be a meaningless warning note, and yet she is murdered just hours after receiving it. So it has to mean something. Now, what I'm hoping, or what I was hoping when I wrote the book, was that readers would just not be able to think of a single reason why that might happen, or a single possible explanation. And then they would have to read on to find out. And that was how I felt with so many of Agatha's books. So yeah, she absolutely is my role model in terms of what crime novels should offer to readers.
You say you like starting with that kind of hook at the start.
Yeah.
And like no seemingly possible explanation for why that would be the case. So you have to keep reading. How long does it take when you have that premise to work it out yourself? Like how long before you know how it all happens? Or do you already know that and work the other way around?
No, if the first idea I have for a book is the mysterious plot hook, the sort of mystery premise, then that is always, at the point when I have that idea, that's all I've got. And I used to worry that that would be all I would ever have and that I wouldn't be able to write the book because I, you know, the sort of outlandishness and apparent impossibility would mean that there literally is no solution that I can come up with. But then I mulled it over and mulled it over. And for the first three or four crime novels that I wrote, I just had the experience time after time of going, oh, that's obviously the solution. And I didn't think I'd be able to make it work. So now, However outlandish and weird the premise, I just totally 100% trust that I will be able to solve that mystery. And it's my desperation to solve the mystery that lets me know that readers will be desperate to solve it too. It's like I'm road testing my own mystery to see how gripped and intrigued I am by it. So what usually happens is then once I know I love the premise, then I will start to mull over possible solutions. Now, the process of coming up with one that I love and that I know is right can take anything from a few weeks to the longest it's ever taken is 9 months. But I'm kind of not in a hurry because I've always usually, you know, I'm writing a different book where I thought of the plot many years ago or many months ago. So when I have an idea, I usually know that I've got months or years to add to it before I need to actually write it. I've got kind of like a queued up system of all these novels queued up waiting to go.
You're keeping quite busy because you're also doing this mentorship for other writers. And I think you're teaching as well.
Yeah, I teach at the University of Cambridge. I'm the course director of the Crime and Thriller Writing Master's Programme, which is an amazing programme that basically teaches people who want to be crime writers or who are crime writers everything they could possibly need to know about how to do that brilliantly and succeed as a crime writer. And I also run a coaching program for writers of every and any possible kind. So this is not just for crime writers. It's not just for fiction writers. It's called Dream Author Coaching. And it's basically a coaching program that equips writers and anyone who wants to write. So it's also open to people who haven't written yet, but really want to. And maybe people who've always wanted to write, but been too scared to try or thought that it was frivolous and they shouldn't try, but the dream of writing a book just won't go away. So it's for anybody who either writes or would love to write. And what it is a coaching program that equips writers or people who want to write with all the tools and concepts and skills and sort of courage that they need to be able to be their own best ally and advocate for the rest of their writing lives. So it's not a writing course. My University of Cambridge master's program, that's a writing course. But my Dream Author coaching program really is coaching. It's life and career coaching for writers or anyone who wants to write.
That sounds amazing. But then it also sounds like you're keeping very busy. Plus you have books coming out quite regularly. So does that become a struggle?
This will remind you of what I just said. There are the facts and then there's how we choose to think about them. So the fact is, I have many different activities that I enjoy doing and want to carry on doing. It's my choice whether I think of it as a struggle or not. The minute we tell ourselves something is a struggle, we feel terrible about it. Unless it's like, you know, sometimes I'll say to myself, I'm on a one-woman heroic mission to do all the things brilliantly. That can be a sort of motivating, empowering thought. But the minute I tell myself, oh, there's so much to do, there's never enough hours in the day, then I feel terrible and then I've got a problem. So what I do is I choose what I want to do and then I think thoughts on purpose about what I've chosen to do that enable me to do it without feeling stressed, pressured, miserable. Now, you can see from how I answered that question that that is like the dream author approach to life. And for me, this has been a real game changer. So like I used to say to my husband, like, oh, it's going to be a terrible day tomorrow. I have to get up and do my page proof reading, which is a kind of boring chore. You just read through the book you've already read 5,000 times while you were writing it and find typos and correct them. So now I would never say I have to do my proofs. Well, I always think I'm actually going to choose to spend tomorrow doing my proofs because it's really important to me that when my book goes out, there aren't loads of mistakes in it. So that's why I want to do it. Is it going to be 100% fun while I'm doing it? Definitely not. But I do nevertheless want to do it. And it just changes everything. So Dream Author is all about transforming our experience of life by choosing our thoughts and beliefs on purpose rather than being at the effect of like random thoughts that we've just acquired from somewhere.
When we called this episode Secrets and Lies, I didn't realize that we would be treated to Sophie Hannah's Secret to Life. So that's been great. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. So I love novels where horrible things happen in really beautiful, pristine environments. And obviously that's what you get from this. And I noticed a blog post on your website about your obsession with spas, which I really loved. And I think you've got a previous book that's set in a 5-star spa resort.
I've got my book that's called Did You See Melody? That is set in a 5-star spa resort in Arizona.
So I was wondering, is this based on a real travel experience that you had? Are any of these couples people that you interacted with when you were traveling? Is Tevenden real in any way, shape or form?
No. So it's interesting. So when I wrote Did You See Melody? The spa resort, which is just out of this world, the spa resort I created in that book, I would love to be able to go to. That was kind of an amalgam of two real spas that I had been to in Arizona. Bears no resemblance to anywhere I have ever been. It's basically what I did was I sort of imagined it was very important that it should be in the UK. That was the first thing. It couldn't be an international resort because Simon Waterhouse just would not get on a plane readily. So I knew that Charlie would stand a better chance of getting him there if it was more local. But I wanted it to be such a beautiful, luxurious UK resort that people would obviously go there in preference to foreign resorts. I wanted it to be plausible that people would say, well, why on earth would we go to an airport and get on a plane when we can go to Tevenden, which is the best place ever? So structurally, elements of the resort were taken from resorts I'd been to. So I once went to a resort in Corfu, which was beautiful, and it had about 12 little cottages, each of which had their own private swimming pool. And then there was a main resort pool and a main resort restaurant and gym. So it was kind of like you had your own accommodation and your own bit, but it was also these houses were all linked together by some shared space. So in a way, Tevenden was kind of a version of that. But basically, it is an invented resort, just based on my extensive knowledge of resorts, domestic and foreign. And the characters are not at all based on anyone I've ever met on holiday. And in fact, when I go on holiday, I do my damnedest to make sure that I don't meet anyone. Like, you see other people around the pool, but my husband many years ago introduced a rule, which was no holiday friends. We'll sometimes go on holiday with friends, that's fine. But when we're on holiday, my husband has forbidden me from chatting to people and ending up in a situation where you might get to know people on holiday. Because once many years ago, I chatted to some people on holiday and then we couldn't get rid of them for the whole rest of the holiday. So we now have this firm policy that we don't do that.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been such a big pleasure. Absolutely. Look forward to seeing what Simon and Charlie get up to next when you have time for a new adventure. And hopefully they will maybe Charlie will be able to persuade Simon to come to Dubai one day, which would be amazing. Until next time, do check out the book, The Couple at the Table, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks very much.